This is Jeff Midkiff. You are listening to Acoustic Music Talk with Brad Apple.
Welcome to Acoustic Music Talk, where we explore the art of acoustic music and musicians with your host, Brad Apple.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome to Acoustic Music Talk. I'm your host, Brad Apple, and again, we welcome you. This week, we're going to be talking to Mr. Dan Crary. If you're like me, Dan played such an important part in my flat picking history. I listened to him continually for a long time, had all of his records and a lot of his instructional materials, and I tell you, when it came to flat picking fiddle tunes, there's hardly any better than Dan Crary. He certainly set the stage for what flat-picking guitar was to be when he started doing this back many years ago. So Dan and I talked by phone the other day, and we got to talk about his career, his thoughts on flat-picking guitar and the history of it, and his own experiences in bluegrass bands and as a solo performer. So let's go ahead and get into that interview with Dan Crary. Well, Dan, thank you for being on the show. I sure appreciate getting to talk to you, and you've been a hero to myself and so many of us out here in the flat picking and bluegrass world, and it's just a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Dan, you have established yourself in history as one of the leading innovators of the flat pick guitar, and I was wondering if you could take us back once again to the early days when you were starting out, what got you interested in the guitar, and what was it like back then when flat pick guitar really was unheard of?
Well, let's see. I guess I would take us back to two different times. One is when I started to play the guitar as a kid, when I was sort of 12 years old. I'll take you back to that time, and then I'll take you back to the early days of when I was in bluegrass. I guess that would be a good answer, because when I started playing in 1952, people can't really understand this, but the guitar itself was really obscure, not just flat picking. And there were lots of guitars around, but nobody was playing much lead on acoustic guitar. And the lead that was being played was on electric guitars, pretty much. But somehow, I was lucky, and when I was 12 years old, just spinning the AM radio dial, and there was a program on Kansas City. I think it was on a station called KMBC, and there was an old boy named Don Sullivan who had a noon hour country music radio show every day on AM radio. It must have gone out over five states, this station. And back in those days, one guy and a guitar could have a radio show live if he had a sponsor. And Don Sullivan got a sponsor, and he was one of these old-time twangy country music singers, and he tuned his guitar a little bit low in order to accommodate his voice, I believe. But it had a wonderful twangy, jangly, steel string sound. And there was something about me. I didn't know anything about country music. I'd never been around it, but I loved that sound. And, later in life, when I was working on a radio station myself in Kansas City, just as an announcer, I told that story. And by gosh, Don Sullivan called me while I was on the air. And I got a chance to thank him personally for getting me interested in the guitar.
That's great.
So that was a funny world back then, because people just didn't play the acoustic guitar seriously. On the other hand, there was one guy who did. In 1952, there was one guy who played steel string acoustic guitar seriously, and he did it with a flat pick, and that was Hank Snow. And sometimes, yeah, Hank Snow doesn't get credit for being one of the early flat pickers, but he certainly was. And he always played lead music on the guitar with his band. Now he could afford to hire a top band and so forth and so on, but he always played lead guitar, and further later in my life, I had an opportunity at a big country music show to be the MC, and I got to MC him and stand about 10 feet from him and watch him do that stuff. So that was really great. Well, somewhere along in there, I also heard bluegrass on AM radio. And if you can imagine, bluegrass music on AM radio, back in the early 1950s, bluegrass was just part of country music.
Right.
And it was not unusual for you to hear bluegrass bands on a country music show. And so I got to hear the Stanley Brothers, and I got to hear the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers, and got to hear Flatt and Scruggs, of course, and Bill Monroe, and I really took to bluegrass music. But nobody was putting flat picking together with bluegrass at that point much. A little bit later on, Don Reno did, because Reno, the wonderful banjo guy, also played guitar somewhat, but I didn't hear Don Reno until quite a bit later. So those were my early exposures to our music, and I loved it. But it was a long time before I ever got to participate in bluegrass music or even see it live. And as late as the middle 60s, when I was living in California and going to school out there, I had never seen live any of the bluegrass bands that I'd listened to on the radio. And I remember Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys were going to come to California and play a concert, and I was standing outside the door of the concert hall with my tickets in my hand, and they announced that Monroe's bus had broken down and he wasn't going to get there. So I still didn't get to see any of this. But finally, when I moved to Louisville, Kentucky, because there was a graduate school there I was going to go to, in Louisville, Kentucky, they were a little bit closer to the music, and I got to go to a festival and see all of my heroes finally in the mid-60s. About that same time, I met some guys that played in the bluegrass band and wanted us to form a band. And so some of the early guys in my life were people like Lonnie Pierce and Ebo Walker and Buddy Spurlock, Danny Jones, and some guys like that. We formed a bluegrass band in Louisville, Kentucky. And I was playing a little bit of lead, but not very much, because it just wasn't done in bluegrass music. There wasn't anybody much that was playing lead in a regular touring bluegrass band that you would hear.
Right.
So Lonnie Pierce, the elder member of our band and our fiddle player, said, "Dan, you ought to play some lead on the guitar and play some of these fiddle tunes." And so I said, "Well, that's an interesting idea." So I started working out leads, and We got a gig there in Louisville, and so we were playing five nights a week, and I was trying to figure out some lead stuff to play on the guitar. And I wasn't thinking about that it was unusual or anything, but then as it happened, at one of our local concerts, the Carlton Haney, I'm trying to think of that name, Carlton was the guy who sort of started the bluegrass festivals in the mid-60s. Bluegrass festivals were kind of invented in the 60s. Right. And Carlton Haney was the first guy to put on these big festivals. And he heard our band and booked us at his big festival in Camp Springs, North Carolina, I think it was, for about 1969. I believe that was the first one. And so what that was like, in answer to your question of what it was like back there, is that we played pretty well, but we were really scared, and I don't think we played brilliantly at that festival. But as far as I know, we were the only band there where the guitar player was playing breaks. Flat picking just was not part of it. Now, there were some guys there that could play, and you know, there was Charlie Waller was there with the Country Gentleman, and later Charlie Waller was one of the great rhythm players of bluegrass music, and later he demonstrated that he could flat pick and it's so beautiful it would make you cry. But he wasn't doing it at that festival, and Larry Sparks was there with Ralph Stanley, and of course Larry Sparks is a fabulous flat picker and could have done it in those days, but they just weren't having him do that. And so our band had a big surprise effect. And when I would take a guitar break, people would sort of stop eating their sandwich and look up and be surprised at that. I remember that that Don Reno and Bill Harrell, who were camped over behind the stage, when we started playing and played guitar breaks, they came running to see who was doing that. Well, I don't think the breaks were very good, but the fact that we were the only band at the festival that was playing guitar breaks in 1969 got a lot of attention, and so it helped our reputation. And from then on, we were expected to play guitar breaks, and I think that some other bands started to think about, well, that we could be doing that too. And of course, then these great guitar players who had not been allowed the opportunity to play guitar breaks started saying, well, you know, let's do a little bit of this.
Who else do you remember coming on the scene shortly after you began flat picking, Dan?
Man, that's a long time ago to remember.
Yeah.
And I was doing a lot of other things at the time, so I wasn't paying so much attention to the other bands, you know. But, of course, one of the people who came out of the woodworks, as far as we were concerned, was Tony Rice. And Tony Rice came out from California, and about 1973, 74, was discovered and started playing with J.D. He started playing first, I guess, with the Bluegrass Alliance, with my old band. And then he started playing with J.D. Crow, and I might be wrong about the years. But somewhere along in there, Tony went back east from California and got discovered, and he started playing in the Bluegrass Alliance and with J.D. Crow and making those early appearances. And, of course, when he arrived on the scene, man, that was the last word, and people knew that flat picking had certainly arrived at that point.
Since we're talking about Tony Rice, Dan, I was wondering if you could share any thoughts about Tony or any special memories that you might have of him. I know you got to play with him a few times. Could you talk to us about Tony?
I wrote a little bit of a tribute to Tony Rice, and so I would refer people to that is online. But Tony and I never got to be around each other very much because I was leaving and going to a different graduate school, and he was just getting established in Kentucky. So we would bump into each other a little bit backstage at gigs and so on, and I always had nice conversations with him, and I got to play with Tony on stage just a very few times. The Walnut Valley Festival out in Kansas that holds the National Flat Picking Championship. At their first festival, booked me. I was at their very first festival, and also among the other amazing flat pickers. And by the way, we have to talk about Doc Watson in this context, because Doc Watson was there certainly before I was, a long time before. But they would book Doc Watson and Norman Blake and me, and they would put us on stage. They put us on stage to play together, which was one of the more terrifying experiences in my life. Because, man, if you're on stage with Doc Watson, you want to do something that is worthy of being in that presence. You know, so at the first festival, the three of us got to play together, and then I think it was the next year or 2 years later that it was those three people, and they had booked Tony Rice too. So Tony was there, and I have a picture of all four of us on stage, and man, that was more flat picking music than you could shake a stick at. It was absolutely great.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that Tony Rice achieved is that his music sort of defined. I think of Tony a lot like Earl Scruggs. Earl Scruggs, of course, was the central figure in the history of bluegrass music that defined what that music is like. And there were a lot of people who added to the definitions of bluegrass music. I think Lester Flatt added to it permanently. Bill Monroe, of course, certainly permanently influenced bluegrass music. Earl Scruggs, I think any banjo player, and certainly my partner, Bill Evans, will tell you this, was the key establishing figure in bluegrass music. And you can still hear the genius of Earl Scruggs when you listen to bluegrass music today being played by other people. Tony Rice, I think, did the same thing. I think that his approach to bluegrass and the amazing, solid, bluesy, ironic things that his genius thought of to play actually made a permanent mark in bluegrass music that you still hear today. So I certainly consider him to be one of the seminal permanent historic figures in our music. And he and I always got along great, had great conversations, made a couple of recordings together, and I was very, very sorry to see him pass.
You're listening to Acoustic Music Talk with your host, Brad Apple.
So how long were you with the Bluegrass Alliance then?
I'm trying to think. I was going to graduate theological school in Louisville. And I decided that I needed to take a different direction in my life at that time. And I went to a different graduate school, went and studied communication studies, and wound up doing that. But I had to go back to Kansas to do it. So I had to leave the Bluegrass Alliance, I think, after 2 years. I think I was with them for 2 years, and then I had to go back to this other school, and they reorganized at that point.
Okay. Did you cut your first bluegrass guitar record when you were still with the Alliance?
Yes. I cut that with them, and at the behest of Lonnie Pierce again, he urged me to do that. And those guys happily were on that album with me, and I love that album because all of the original Bluegrass Alliance guys were on there.
After you left the Alliance and you said you went back to Kansas for some schooling, how did you come about landing in California?
Well, my first job after graduate school, I was going to school to be a professor, and the jobs that were open to me when I finished my graduate work there numbered precisely one. And it happened to be in Fullerton, California, so I said yes to that and picked up and moved me and the family to Fullerton, California, where I became a professor and spent 30 years teaching students there at Cal State Fullerton. And it happened to be about an hour down the freeway from Byron Burline. So that's how I connected up with those guys and wound up in my second bluegrass band, was that the move to California took me very close to Burline and John Hickman and those guys.
Okay. I also was wondering what guitars you played early on in your career. And I know I'll get on into your signature model Taylor here in a minute, but I was wondering what kind of guitars you started out with. I know you had a Mossman for a while.
Yeah, going back a little earlier, when I first joined the Bluegrass Alliance, the one sort of really top model guitar that I had ever owned, I had gotten as a gift when I was a kid. My family pooled their money and bought me a Gibson J200, a guitar that I still have. It's a beautiful guitar, but it's not a very bluegrassy guitar.
Right.
And it does not cut through with those other instruments like the stereotypical and standard Martin D28. And so when I was playing with the Alliance, I played with that guitar for a while, and my partner sort of looked at that and were thinking, and finally not only thinking but saying, that's not a real bluegrass guitar and you need to have a D28. So I played a guy's D28 with the band and realized, yes, it did sound quite differently, and that was the kind of instrument that you need to have when you're playing against banjos and fiddles and all of those instruments. That, I don't know if people realize this, but a bluegrass band is it's a conspiracy to drown out the guitar, you know, those fiddles and banjos and mandolins are quite a bit louder and So I, for some time, I borrowed Danny Jones's nice D, was it a D-35? I think it was a D-28. Anyway, I borrowed his guitar for a while. And he and I had a mandolin that he wanted to play, so we played each other's instruments for a while. And eventually, I had to get me a D-28, and I had a couple of really nice ones. And then, along about, well, fairly early in my life there, along came Stuart Mossman, who was from Kansas and from Winfield, Kansas, the town where the Walnut Valley Festival has happened for the last sort of 48 years. And Mossman approached me about playing one of his instruments, and he and I got to be good pals. And so for some years, I did play Mossman guitars, and on occasion, I still do. I still have a couple of them. And his idea was to make an instrument that was more balanced than the standard Dreadnought Martin guitars. And that was good because, again, under the heading of a guitar that will cut through and hold its own among all of those other very, very prominent instruments like fiddles and banjos and so on. Having a little bit more treble in the mix was a good idea, and the Mossman guitars were quite good for that. Then as Mossman, I played those Mossman guitars for some years. Mossman unfortunately became sick and passed away early in his life, and about the time that the Mossman Company was going into retreat, I think Mossman Guitars still exist right now, but somewhere along in there, the company went into retreat, and I don't know the history of it, and Mossman himself passed away, unfortunately, and I miss him. He was a good friend. But he was also influential on other people. And along came Bob Taylor of Taylor Guitars, and when I met him and started listening to Taylor Guitars, I realized that that this guy was also a genius guitar maker. And as I remember a conversation with Bob Taylor, he said that one of the things that Mossman did was to show the way that somebody could come up with some new ideas in the acoustic guitar game. So somewhere along in the, I'm trying to get these dates straight, around late 70s, 1980, something like that, I played some Taylor guitars, had a conversation with Bob. I thought their 12-string guitars were the greatest ones that I had ever played, and but their 6-string guitars were, again, very heavily weighted on the bass side. And so I had a conversation with Bob about my need for a bluegrass guitar would be one that would, again, compete with the other acoustic instruments in the band and sound great and blend in with a banjo and a fiddle and so on. So he said, well, if that's your opinion, how about if you and I make a guitar? And so he and I did. And by he and I, he made the guitar, and I had the opinions. And I remember writing down from my home in Fullerton, California, on the train to San Diego about 5 or 6 different times. And Bob would have advanced the cause of the guitar and would want me to listen to it, and we'd have a conversation about it. And so the Dan Crary Taylor guitar was created in that process. And I understand that even though they're not making that guitar these days, that it has become an item. And Dan Crary has become a historical figure, and so has the Dan Crary guitar. That doesn't mean that I'm not playing, but anyway, there are Dan Crary guitars around for sale. I know people that that have bought them on the premium guitar market, and that's where that history came about, was as a sort of development from my J200 to my D28s, to my Mossmans, to my Dan Crary Taylor, and I still play that. I'm still playing the Crary Taylor model.
If I remember correctly, I've read before on the Dan Crary signature model Taylor, the top is thinner, actually, and the braces are a little thicker, right?
Yes, that was Bob's idea, was to make the top thinner and the by a few thousandths, and the braces a little bit heavier. And what that produces is a shift in the tonality toward the treble side. There's plenty of bass in the guitar, as anybody who's ever tried to play one of them on a standard microphone will tell you. You have to position it just right to balance that bass. There's a huge bass ring that comes off of that guitar, but it also has those mid-rangey and treble tones mixed in that give it the balanced sound. And so, for me, balance is volume is important, and so is balance. And I think we achieved that with that instrument.
Yeah, I would agree. The ones I've heard are very balanced guitars and really cut through the mix really nicely.
I still like mine. In fact, I'm still playing the prototype that Bob and I worked on all of those weeks. It is in wonderful shape. Tim Lawrence, who was one of the key people at the Taylor Guitar Company in those days, has adjusted it and refretted it and set it up for me. It sounds absolutely fabulous, and Bob and I talk on the phone about that guitar every once in a while.
What kind of picks do you use, Dan? I had that down to ask you.
Well, I started out with a very light and thin pick, and then I went to heavy picks, and I've tried everything anymore. A sort of Fender medium is the thing, and I turn it around and play on the corner, the sort of rounded corner.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the pick of choice anymore. I tried, it's unfortunately, tortoiseshell picks are wonderful, but they're a little bit stiff and brittle. And unfortunately, a tortoise has to give its life in order for you to have one. So
right.
That was sort of unfortunate.
Yeah.
And I decided to, I evolved into playing with Fender mediums, actually.
Okay. You've made a lot of great recordings through the years. And I wanted to ask you in particular, one of my favorites when it came out and still is Thunderation. And I was going to ask you about that particular recording because that was sort of a departure in a way. I would call it flavored more like some of the Windham Hill records that were coming out back years ago.
Yeah.
How'd that record come about?
Exactly. At that time, I was making bluegrass records for Sugar Hill Records. And the Windham Hill phenomenon came along with a kind of music that came to be known as New Age music, I believe was the title for it. Am I right about that?
Yes, sir. I believe that's right.
That's right. I'm trying to remember all of this morning after only two cups of coffee. It's 3 hours earlier out here, so, I'm still brushing the sleep out of my eyes. Actually, I'm wide awake and happy to talk to you, but I'm trying to remember way back to some of these events, and the coffee is kicking in. That's really good. New Age music featured quite a bit of acoustic guitar music, and there were some New Age guitar heroes. Barry Poff at Sugar Hill Records and I agreed that I should try my hand at making a New Age flat picking album, and the album called Thunderation is the result of that. I worked with Billy Oske, an amazing engineer, at a studio up in Oregon, and Billy and I created this album called Thunderation, which it's all guitar instrumentals, and it's flat picking, and it's melodic, but we used a lot of studio effects and tried different arrangements and did some overdubs of multiple guitar tracks and did some of that new agey stuff. And yeah, I still like to hear the Thunderation album. Some of the music from that is still in my repertoire when I play live, and so that's where that came from.
I really like how you redid Lime Rock and you put the different introduction and conclusion on it there before you got into the head of the tune there. That was really cool.
That's right. Lime Rock was on that album. That's right.
Yeah.
I still play that tune. I can't play it with all of those different effects, but I still play the tune, and it still sounds nice on the recording, I think.
It does, yep. Talk about your influence. I've had some of your instruction tapes before, and I know you talked a lot about a flamenco influence on your playing, and especially in like the dynamics of flamenco players.
The greatest guitar performance of any kind that I ever saw was a concert at William Jewell College outside of Kansas City, Missouri, of a guitar player whose name was, whose professional name was Sabikas. And I loved flamenco music. It was sort of the next thing I loved after bluegrass. And when I heard my first flamenco guitar players, I was just stunned at it. I never was able to play flamenco myself because that's a completely horse of a different matter. You play with fingers and fingernails, and you play with a completely different kind of guitar. So I was an admirer of it, and I loved it, and I still do today. But I never really was able to play flamenco. But there was some stuff that that I could learn from the flamenco players, including dynamics and tone, and especially the dynamics of it. And so I think I was influenced by that and played Rasgueados with a pick and bore down on some of the bass strings harder than I would have if I had not heard the flamenco players and heard what they could do with that. So I think it was good for my playing to listen to the flamenco guys and try in my own country boy flat-picking way to imitate some of their moves and then integrate that into some of the fiddle tunes and the bluegrassy stuff. And just as other players have been heavily influenced by blues and bluegrass, I think I was a little influenced by flamenco players. And by the way, that night in William Jewell College, I had listened to Sabikas for many years and had most of his albums, and that night I got to see him live for the first time, and he came out, responded with a big smile to the applause from the audience, and tripped amazingly and almost catastrophically over a sort of a piece of stage furniture that they had put out there by his chair. You know, a flamenco player just sits down in a chair and puts his foot up on a stool. But for this concert, they had put some sort of a sound reflector out, and as Sabikas was walking to his chair before playing a note, he tripped, gosh almighty, over that thing and almost went to the floor and almost smashed his guitar, but he caught himself.
Oh, goodness.
And sat down and collected himself for a minute, and in the middle of his first piece, he just stopped playing. He lost it because he was still rattled from almost falling to the floor. And then after that, it was like Sabikas got hold of himself and played the most furiously that I ever heard him play or any other guitar player.
Wow.
And so it was a night where Sabikas had to recover himself after an accident.
Yeah.
And I've never seen anything like that, and I'm sure that experience was infused in everything I did from then on.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to ask you, Dan, how do you feel about the direction that the art of flat pick guitar is going nowadays? Do you think it's in good hands with the players we've got, and do you have any particular new and up-and-coming players on the scene that you are aware of that you are paying attention to these days?
Oh, man, you know, if I start naming names, I'm going to leave some people off the list that ought to be on that list. But, you know, the younger players coming along now, and female players, you know, there never used to be any female flat pickers, and now there are really good ones. And so I think the young players and the female players are all doing exactly what they ought to be doing, which is loving the roots of the music. You can hear the roots of the music in their playing, and then they're reaching out and finding new things to do. And I'm not going to make a list because inevitably, just sitting here trying to make it up off the cuff, I'd leave out some people. So just let me say a word of congratulations to the new young players. You're not going to hear me be one of those guys say, oh, this is the way we did it in our youth, so you ought to do the same thing. Oh, no, I think it's really great.
Yeah.
And, you know, future audiences are going to figure out what the future of our music is.
Right.
And that's the way it ought to be. You play to people and you inspire them, and if you get through to their hearts and their souls, then your music will survive and prevail. And that's the way Bill Monroe did it, and that's the way Earl and Lester and Chubby Wise did it. It's the way Doc Watson did it, and so forth. They found an audience, and the interplay between the audience and the genius of the player created the music of today.
Yep.
And let me go back to Doc Watson. Can we do that for a minute?
Yes, sir.
So all of that talk about, well, Don Reno was back there and those other early players and so forth, and then in the mid-60s, we did what we did. Doc Watson has been there all along, not quite as early as, well, somewhere there in the 50s, Doc Watson came on the scene, and everybody was completely blown away by what he was doing. And so in some ways, the most influential of all flat pickers, yeah, I would say the most influential of all flat pickers is Doc Watson.
Yeah.
Because he was doing it in his world, and I guess he would define it as the solo player and the folk music and the old-time music world. Doc Watson was flat picking way, way back there before anybody heard of any of the rest of us, with the possible exception of Don Reno. And memory of the calendar is not quite precise enough to say who came first, but actually one of the first flat pickers was Bill Monroe, who was quite a serious flat picker at one time in his life, and yep. wound up exclusively pretty much on the mandolin. But Bill played the guitar, and he was, you know, way, way back there. But Doc Watson came along, and the first I heard of him, of course, was in the 50s. And Doc was this incredible musician who could finger pick. He could flat pick. He could join Flatten Scruggs on a Columbia bluegrass album that had to be fabulous, and it was. And he could also work with really deeply old-time traditional musicians and fit right in with them. He was also a fabulous character who was smart and wise and did amazing things. And I used to enjoy sitting around backstage and talking to Doc Watson. He would tell me such interesting things about his life. Like one time he said, you know, Dan, I've been building a shortwave antenna on my, I think he said, on his garage. And remember, Doc Watson was a blind person.
Mm-hmm.
And had been blind since childhood. He did all kinds of things. He worked on his house. He got up on ladders, and he installed the antenna for a shortwave radio that he bought. And I said, Doc,
wow.
Doc, that's really interesting. What got you interested in this? He said, I decided I wanted to listen to the BBC. And in those days, you know, there wasn't cable TV and
yep.
and all of that. And so if you wanted to listen to the BBC, you had to get a shortwave radio and listen to it from England. And Doc decided that he wasn't getting the straight story from the news media. He said, I don't think the news people are telling me the straight story or the whole story. And he thought that the BBC would tell him that whole story. So Doc
yeah.
Watson, the man whose hands were priceless in this world, the guy who could not see from childhood, was up on the roof of his garage installing the antenna for a shortwave radio, as I understood his story that he was telling me,
wow.
so that he could listen to the BBC to get the news.
Wow, that's an awesome story.
That's the kind of guy he was. And he loved his son and his grandson and his family. I'll tell you another story about Doc Watson. The first time I saw him was way back in the late 60s when I was in Louisville playing with the Bluegrass Alliance. The Bill Monroe festival grounds were just across the river up in Indiana at, I forget the name of the town in Indiana, but anyway, not too far from the Ohio River. And I went up there for a festival one day, and Doc Watson was going to appear at that festival, And Doc did appear. I have a couple of pictures that I took of him. I guess that's the second time I saw him alive. And he had come to Bean Blossom, Indiana. That's the name of the town, Bean Blossom. He had ridden from North Carolina to Indiana by himself with a guitar and his suitcase. He had come up on the bus as a blind person.
Oh, wow.
So the guy could get around, and he could depend on people to help him get off and on the right bus and make it to Indiana and play gigs way back then. So he truly was one of the most monumental human beings and one of the most sweet, brilliant, powerful musicians that the world has ever seen. And it was a great privilege of mine to know Doc a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know he was on your Jammed If I Do record, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah. Got to play a duet with him. Another scary session where you want to play something that is worthy of being in the same room with Doc Watson, which is not easy to do.
Speaking of sessions, Dan, let me ask you this. When you go in the studio, do you have a particular setup you like a pair of microphones or anything particular, or do you just leave that to the engineer?
Well, I sort of leave it to the engineer, but I also listen to it and have a lot of opinions about it. Billy Oskey and I worked in many sessions with Billy, and he and I pretty much agreed on very high-powered microphones, and they needed to be in a couple of places. So the stereo mics, one was sort of pointed at the bass side of the guitar, and another one was pointed more at the treble side of the guitar, and then, of course, they were mixed in a beautiful stereo mix.
Yeah.
And I did leave that up to the engineer, but with a lot of opinions from me.
Well, I know that the COVID pandemic has affected all artists, but could you tell us what you're working on right now and what you plan on doing, hopefully, when this pandemic is over?
Well, I've been on the phone with a couple of really good pals of mine who are currently in a band with me. Bill Evans and Wally Barnick are my current partners. We have been completely flidoranged for a year and not able to find a gig just like everybody else, but we've sort of kept in touch and we've promised each other that we're going to get together the next time it's possible. Our next gig that we actually have booked is at the Walnut Valley Festival in September. We were pretty sure that nothing else was going to happen before that, so we're actually supposed to be at the 49th and 50th of the Walnut Valley Festival. And so we've been planning how we're going to get ready for that. I have not seen my partners for a year now, and I'm sure we're going to fall back into it, but we're going to need a little rehearsal time to remember the arrangements. And so we've been on the phone planning to do that, and the present plan is that we may go to New Mexico to do some gigs and to do some warm-up in September. Bill Evans is the great banjo man and the guru to banjo players of the world. Fantastic player and a great guy. Wally Barnick is that soulful singer who can break your heart with a song, and a solid bass man as well. And I just love to work with these guys. They are fantastic human beings and really cool players. And we're scheming to come back. We're not gone yet, buddy. We're going to come back at you and play us some tunes that'll, as people used to say in bluegrass, it'll make you bleed from the ears.
And you guys have a recording together too, don't you?
Yes, we have a couple of them. And the most recent one, I'm not going to remember the title to this album, is called Prime Time, which is very appropriate for three guys who are in our generation. And you can get that from my website if you care to do that. That would be nice.
What does Dan Curry enjoy doing besides music? Do you have any hobbies, or when you don't have something on the calendar to play or do otherwise, what do you like doing?
Well, I like playing with my dogs. I have a couple of wonderful dogs, one of whom is a mutt that we adopted from a shelter in Lodi, California. His name is Lodi, and he's a little mixed breed terrier. And we have another dog whose name is Razy, and Razy is a schnoodle and has a sort of extra hyper personality. I love playing with my dogs.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a reader when I can be, and I like to read. I'm kind of a fan of medieval history. I like to read about all of the weird stuff that went on back around the 14th, 15th century. So that's fun. Like to listen to, and I like to listen to medieval music. There's, I guess I could have become one of those guys that actually seriously studies that time, but I've read some books and listened to that music a lot, and that probably crept into my bluegrass music as well. So if you buy one of my records and there's a little moss growing on the edge of the music, it may come from reading some of that stuff about knights and kings and all of the follies of the 14th century.
Yeah, okay. Hey, I think there might be some of that influences on the Thunderation record, come to think of it.
Maybe. Could be. Yeah, there's a little moss growing around the edges of some of those tunes. So.
Yeah. Well, Dan, thank you so much for talking to me today and being on the show. And it's certainly been a pleasure having you and talking to you about your career in this music.
Well, thanks. I've enjoyed a little reminiscing and going down memory lane with you, too. Thanks, and all the best to you in that enterprise. And you realize that there will be an extra echelon of reward in heaven for people that to get nice music in other people's lives and enriched in that way. So good going.
Well, thanks, everybody, for listening to this week's episode of Acoustic Music Talk. We invite you back again next time, where we'll have another interesting conversation with one of the greats of the acoustic music world. Until then, please stay safe out there, and I'm your host, Brad Apple.
Thank you for listening to Acoustic Music Talk. Join us again next week for another episode as we continue to explore the world of acoustic music.